Welcome to the Packet Pushers podcast. This is a Priority Queue show, and I'm Ethan Banks, at EC Banks on Twitter. Let me set this thing up for you, what we're going to be talking about today. It's a bit about IPv6, and here's what happened. I am a speaker at Interop, and I at the Las Vegas show in 2015, I had an occasion to ask some of the people that were in front of me whether or not they were deploying IPv6. They said no. And almost nobody, very few hands went up. Of course, this is a North American audience. Worldwide, there'd be much more interest in IPv6, generally speaking. But that got me thinking about some things related to IPv6. And then something else came up where I got briefed by a vendor, a startup company, who was putting a new product out on the market. And I asked them about their IPv6 support and the product. And they said, well, no one's been asking for it. It's not really a priority for us. We'll bake it in sometime later. It's not really a hard thing for us to do. It's just not a big deal right now. And I kind of, my brain snapped a little bit, and because I think IPv6 is important, and I did a quick blog post that said IPv6 still no love ? And then had some points in there where I basically say, you know, vendors aren't supporting it as well as they ought to be, and enterprises aren't taking it seriously, and, you know, and I made a few other points there, and I got taken to task by someone who knows me from Cisco, and I'll have him introduce himself now. Alain Fiocco. I probably didn't pronounce it even close to right, because it already forgot in my brain when you told me how to pronounce it, and my brain's like,
no worries, no worries.
Because it's outrageous in French. So tell me, would you introduce yourself to the audience, please?
Sure. So my name is Alain Fiocco. So you did it good, actually. Okay. I'm actually a senior director at Cisco. I'm actually part of the CTO of this organization. And more specifically related to the topic of today, I'm actually the head of the IPv6 High Impact Project at Cisco. And so I've been driving IPv6 strategy for the whole company for a few years now.
Mm-hmm. So, okay. Now, you saw my blog post and you responded on Google+, basically telling me, dude, you're wrong, and you're spreading FUD, and that you're making me crazy. And then so we kind of went back and forth on G+ for a little bit, where we kind of explained each other's positions. And it settled out that you kind of agreed with me and didn't. And so I thought it would be good just for us to bang through a lot of this stuff that you had raised on your Google+ post and share it with the audience, because you made a lot of great points that are worth sharing. Now, there was some stuff you agreed with me, but then there was a lot of other stuff that you disagreed with me on because of nuance, where if you expand the conversation, there's things that make it a lot bigger conversation to be having about IPv6 deployments and where we're actually at globally. Let's talk briefly about some of the stuff you kind of did agree with me on, and let you explain your position here. One thing you had said was, yeah, there are vendors that don't do a good job of supporting V6, and sometimes when they do it, it isn't really deployment ready. You know, on the other hand, there's exceptions to that with other vendors who do a really good job. So what was your take on that?
I think the place where we kind of meet, and I completely agree with you, that the industry as a whole may not be 100% ready for IPv6 deployment throughout, right? It's so the basic situation is that any customer that think they need to deploy V6 or is planning to is going to have to ask some hard questions about which vendor do they have in their infrastructure, which software vendor, hardware vendors, do they do a good job at it, do they don't do a good job at it, and make some design decisions, right? And some of the shortcomings may be relatively easily, you can probably design around those shortcomings, and in other cases, you may have to do some more dramatic change in your infrastructure.
And it's really a multi-part thing you've got to be evaluating. You've got to be evaluating a provider and their readiness to connect you with IPv6, and then, as you said, hardware and software. So there's networking devices that need to support IPv6, and then software in operating systems that need to support IPv6. So that's all different components and pieces and parts that need to support V6.
IP touches everything. IPv6 is no different than IPv4 in that respect. So if you were to think about deploying IPv4 today, you would have to look at whether your provider is supporting it properly, whether your devices, networking devices, as well as endpoint devices, as well as all the middle boxes that you have in between, because there are a lot. It goes from, you know, security devices all the way to load balancers and stuff like that, as well as your operating systems, your software, and your application. So, you know, IPv6 do touch everything, no mm-hmm. question about that. And so evaluating whether or not you are ready to V6 is actually not a very simple task. That we completely agree. I completely agree with you on that. Now, maybe if we step back a little bit and have a look at how much IPv6 is being deployed, because at the end of the day, that's the only measure of success, right? Is how many, what is the percentage of deployments out there, both in the ISP networks, in connecting users, connecting services, connecting content, social media platforms, all these kind of things. And that, to be honest with you, I think there is a little bit of a lack of education here of how well we've done over the last few years, and I mean we as an industry, in deploying V6 in the infrastructure. The internet is largely IPv6 enabled, dual stack pretty much everywhere. And so very, very few ISPs are going to turn you down completely if you ask them for an IPv6 connection.
So, okay, so I'll pause there just for a second and go, I know there's regional providers that aren't giving you IPv6 yet because I happen to have one. I mean, I'm a residential customer, yeah. Not enterprise, but you know, I can't get IPv6. I've asked about it. I actually looked up their local AS number. They're not advertising any IPv6 blocks right now, et cetera.
Yeah, I would make a difference between a residential provider and a provider, you know, connecting businesses, mm-hmm. right? And even within those, I mean, as you said, I mean, there are regional ones with a very local footprint and more national one and even some international. So there are different stage of support and deployment. But the good news is that this is information that we have. So we can tell you, you know, country by country, what is the level of deployments in the infrastructure, you know, where the whether they are at the center of the internet, whether there are more peripheral ASs, and obviously it's more important to have the center than the periphery, I mean, all these kind of things. So that is information that we have, and I can tell you that over the last 5 years, there have been a compounding growth rate of ISPs supporting V6 or something like in the range of 30% per year. Mm-hmm. So we are at a point now that if I'm looking at the top 300 ASs in the world, 92% of them are actually IPv6 ready.
Yeah, and okay. So, I mean, if we're talking about global providers and tier one backbone providers and so on, that makes sense to me. We do have a global internet that is IPv6 connected, and that's been that way for a while. And as you're pointing out, it's just continuing to grow.
Yeah, it's continuing to grow, but it's not necessarily continuing to grow in terms of it's actually continuing to expand, right?
Oh, so right, okay.
There are more and more. I mean, the IPv6 is actually penetrating the periphery now, as one would expect, right? You start mm-hmm. from the center, and then, yes, you need to get the level three and the Hurricane Electrics and the big tier ones. And then it goes to the tier twos, and then it goes to the, you know, the local ones. And, you know, in certain countries, 95% of the connections in the country are actually IPv6 ready. I'm talking business connections here. I'm not talking residential. Mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. So, again, the situation varies from places to places. The US is actually quite well positioned in that on that front, although, you know, you have way more AESs and service providers in the US than anywhere else in the world, historical reasons, I would assume. And so the task is quite big, right, to turn all of them up. Some of them are also not growing very fast. They're very stable, right, because they've been there for a long time. And so if they don't grow, they may not have problems with IPv4 address exhaustion.
Which makes sense. I mean, particularly with the way the infrastructure is laid out in the U.S., there's a lot of monopolies. There's a lot of, you know, and if there's not a merger acquisition going on, they may be very happy where they're at.
Exactly. So that there is a lot of that going on, right? Stable markets are less likely to jump on IPv6 simply because they don't necessarily have the needs for more addresses and more, you know, more customers to connect. This being said, if I'm looking now at the residential space, so either fixed or wireless, in particular in the wireless space, there is a lot of growth, and pretty much all of the wireless and fixed line operators, both cable and DSL, are actually turning on V6 and have been turning on V6 for quite some time by default in some cases, and in other cases are just starting. So.
Yeah, for Verizon Wireless, for example. I'm a Verizon customer, and if I look on my iPhone and I dig through the addresses that have been assigned, I've had an IPv6 in addition to an IPv4 address on that phone for a long time now.
Yep. So AT&T is the other example. Comcast, Time Warner Cable, T-Mobile in the US. So the top-tier mobile operators as well as the top-tier you know, fixed-line operators are actually enabling V6 now by default. The thing that is interesting is AT&T is a good example of that. Verizon Wireless is another good example, is that if you get V6, you basically get an end-to-end address. If you get V4, you get a private IPv4 address behind a CGN.
Yes. CGN as in carrier grade net, as in you have some IP address of your own internally. It hits a firewall of your own at the edge of your residential network. They assign you another private IP address, which is going to get netted yet again to something public, and you're going to be sharing that address with a whole bunch of other people regionally, potentially.
And that's exactly the right point. You know, your last sentence is the crux of the issue, because you're going to be sharing not only with the people in your home, like with your NAT in your residential gateway, but you're going to be sharing public IPv4 addresses with people in your neighborhood, your town, your region, depending on the size. Right.
Yeah, and I've read Microsoft has blogged about this on their gaming platform, Xbox. They've been stating, without IPv6, we can't keep certain services around the Xbox One platform working properly, because the translation loses the granularity that is needed to do things like set up a voice chat during a gaming session from point to point. That breaks.
Absolutely. The more you do peer-to-peer connections, and gaming is a good example of that, the more you're going to have to deal with multiple NATs in both directions, and that makes the setup of the session very, very complex. Right? Mm-hmm. Now, if you have both, right, and you go to a website, if that website is IPv6 enabled, by default, your traffic will switch over to V6, and by default, right? It's a preferred channel, and you're never going to eat that NAT, or potentially that, you know, those multiple NATs along the way. Okay, mm-hmm. You're going to go end to end, and you're going to restore the end to end model that we all loved, at least people that are like me over 40 or even 50. Generation may never have experienced that, but you basically restore the end to end model. If the website or the site that you want to connect to is not IPv6 enabled, and that would be the case of a lot of the enterprises that you were talking about in your blog post. If those sites are not V6 enabled, what's going to happen is that the end user is going to switch over to V4, which will be translated multiple times along the way. So the connection from the end users to that perhaps e-commerce site or local, I don't know, health insurance or whatever that may be, or bank, will experience a connection that it will be translated multiple times. And so they may not see, you know, a big issue with that today, but I guarantee you that the end-to-end quality of the connection is degrading over time, and it's degrading pretty fast because IPv4 addresses are running short, and people are going to share more and more aggressively over time. So it's basically the two choices you have as an enterprise is you either serve those IPv6 customers, which is a growing user population, with the native protocol that they are using, i.e. IPv6, or you continue to camp on the IPv4 camp, and then the connection that you're going to get from your end users may have been translated three times along the way. Yeah. If there is some security issues going on, you're going to have no idea who to call, even, right? And where that connection is going to be impacted.
Let me ask you a question here to kind of put some practical. I mean, we know there's still challenges out there, and we're not all, you know, 100% all the way out there with IPv6. But if I'm an enterprise, particularly in North America, where we seem to be lagging behind much of the rest of the world in IPv6 deployments in the enterprise, can I go ahead and do this? And if I do this, where does it make sense to do it? So, and there's really a couple of questions there, because there's a couple of scenarios that come up. One is a scenario that we're familiar with. You do it just at the edge of your enterprise network, and you use some kind of a V6 to V4 translation service at the edge. And then the other is, no, I'm going to go all in, and I'm going to deploy IPv6 throughout my enterprise. Which of those make sense, and, you know, under what circumstances?
So to me, these are not opposite scenarios. So let me – it's actually interesting that you say that North America is lagging behind in terms of enterprise deployments. But North America is actually leading when it comes to end users deployment by far. Actually, there are very few places in the world. There are a few, but there are very few places in the world that have more IPv6 end users, both as an absolute number and as a percentage of the overall internet population in a given country. Very, very few places that are ahead of the US.
Well, then I have a misperception, but I'll tell you where it comes from. It comes from talking to end users, people that deal with the podcast or people that interact with me on my blog, and it's just not interesting to people for the most part. It's one of those things that they put off, and it kind of falls to the bottom of the pile with all the other projects they have to do.
And that's the thing that is interesting is that you have the broadest and the largest user population, which hasn't asked for IPvCs. They got it because the ISPs have decided to turn it on. Mm. You know, 40% of the Comcast users are on IPv6 today. They haven't asked for it. Comcast have turned it on, and because all the equipments along the way are IPv6 enabled by default, you get an IPv6 address on your Windows machine or on your PlayStation or on your Mac, right, or iPhone at home. So those, I mean, we're talking about a big number. We're talking about, you know, about 15, well, actually, now I think we passed 16% of the users' population in the U.S. have IPv6 natively, and 60% of the Verizon Wireless user base. I mean, that's a big number, right? So back to the point, right? Mm-hmm. Those end users are out there. They have IPv6. Now the question is, do we want to serve them with IPv6, or are we relying on a third party somewhere to do the translation for me as an enterprise, right? And I think it is the right place to start. The right place to start for most people. There are a few exceptions, and I'll come to that in a second. But for the vast majority of the businesses, the right place to start is at the internet edge. So your internet edge, your platform where you serve your customers, must be IPv6 enabled so that you can serve those customers with IPv6 natively if they come to you with IPv6. Don't turn them down, right? Now, how do you do that? I mean, so for the people that are using a hosting service to run their internet platform, you know, an Akamai or something like that, you can go to Akamai and ask them to turn it on for you. So you may not even have anything to do by yourself.
Cloudflare is the same way. You know, Packet Pusher's properties, for example, are hosted behind Cloudflare. We just check the box to turn on IPv6. It's there.
Exactly. So that's the minimal entry point. And it's already a good thing to do that, right? And the second phase would be to turn your own internet platform on IPv6, obviously, so that not only the one that are being served by Cloudflare, you know, being accelerated by Cloudflare, will get it, but even the ones that are coming to your own platform, because maybe you do some you know, customer transactions. It may not be the case for Packet Pusher, but if you're a bank, you know, a lot of those customers, you want them to come to you so that you can do the secure banking transaction yourself. You're not going to rely on a third party to do that. Make sure that these transactions happen over V6 so that you have the right level of security, geolocalization, those kind of things, right? Great place to start, which in most cases is going to have an impact at the edge of your data center, right? So what you're going to have to turn on here is IPv6 on your edge routers, IPv6 on your security layer, you know, your firewalls, your intrusion prevention mechanisms, probably your load balancers.
Yeah, I was going to think of like a load balancer or a proxy server. Yeah,
exactly, your proxy servers. And then, you know, as a first phase, you can stop there. You know, that's probably good enough to serve your customers with IPv6. But I can guarantee you that over time, this will be bleeding into your infrastructure, because some of the transactions that you do require to go and talk to a different server, require to go and talk to, maybe you have a widget that runs on your website that comes from, you know, somebody running that widget in an Amazon cloud. So you may have to enable V6 there too. I mean, so it will be bleeding in other places in your network as well, right?
But it's a good having it at the edge is going to drive more IPv6, you know, as a need, as you're saying, and little tools you might have, bits and pieces are going to come in. You really need IPv6 additionally. Should I just plan at the beginning to do a whole deployment, or is this – you said they're not mutually exclusive, these two strategies. So, I mean, I do the edge and then slowly just migrate it inward?
Well, let me tell you what we've done at Cisco. We had – two parallel projects going on, one to enable all the V6 property, all the web properties on V6, and the second one to enable the internal infrastructure. Two different business drivers, two different programs even, because that was not involving the same people, the same products, the same projects, the same applications. So we actually ended up having two parallel projects going on, which obviously there were a lot of things that were done in common, but at the end of the day, even the timing was different, right? And the execution of the projects were different. So we had both. Now, in the second camp, in terms of enabling internal infrastructure, what I see so far is I don't see a lot of mid-size or small-size enterprises turning on V6, but I see a lot of very large enterprises turning on V6 internally because, you know, there are some well-known cases that have been public about it. Microsoft, for example, is realizing that they are running out of RFC 1918 private addresses internally. It's not that they're running out completely, but it makes their life extremely complicated to carry on with IPv4 internally because they need to grow, they need more contiguous subnets, they need to restructure their infrastructure, they need to potentially do some merger and acquisition.
So even a block as big as 10/8 is not big enough for a Microsoft.
Absolutely. And they have, you know, they end up having multiple 10/8. Therefore, they have to NAT between them to provide connectivity, right? Which wow. turn into a complete nightmare scenario. So those kind of enterprises, and there are a few others actually with the same drivers, are deploying V6 and wants to get, and not only they are deploying V6, they had V6 running for quite a while. They are at the point where they want to deactivate V4. They want to sunset V4 as fast as possible because they want to get rid of that complexity and start, you know, moving, growing on V6 so that they benefit from the structured address space, they benefit from the simplicity, the potential for automation, those kind of things.
So a lot of people that just heard you say that went, wait a minute, get rid of IPv4 to get rid of complexity by introducing IPv6? And that made no sense to them. So you got to explain that.
Right. So, I mean, in those cases, most of the time, it's not that they need to introduce V6. It's that they have already introduced V6. And they've been running dual stack for a while. And dual stack in itself does not reduce the complexity that you had with V4. It's just, you just carry on with it. And you deploy V6 on top of it. Once you have V6 deployed in a dual stack fashion, you can start thinking about getting rid of V4 because that you get rid of that complexity and the not only the V4 complexity in itself, but the dual stack complexity. The fact that you kind of adding another layer of complexity, which is to make the decision between V4 and V6 in the first place, right? And every time you have an issue somewhere, you never know if that connection was established over V6 or V4. So you have to double check that both works properly. And it changes all the time because of the nature of the protocol, right? A given end user may be connected over V6 at some point, and then if, you know, the response time on V6 for whatever reason is not as good as it should be, you may fall back to V4 or vice versa. And so at any point in time, it's going to be very, very difficult for the operator to know if you were using V4, you were using V6 when you had a problem yesterday.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So,
so you start eliminating IPv4, and all of a sudden it gets a smaller set of things you have to troubleshoot to resolve problems
exactly.
and so on.
The other advantage of V6 over V4 in this particular case is that the address space is so big that people have realized that there is value in that, right? And the value is, you can build semantic in your addressing plan, and you can build all kind of semantic. You can build geographical semantic. You can say, you know, every address that starts with this belongs to this region or this country or this particular operation. You can build business semantic, right? You can say this is finance and this is HR and this is R&D, right? Based on the address. You have that luxury. You don't have to have a very refined and complex contiguous address space like you need to have with V4 because of the constraint space.
You can, because the address space is so large, do
exactly
whatever you like.
Yeah, do whatever you like. Don't feel constrained. Think differently. You know, build your addressing plan so that it makes sense, as opposed to it is technically, you know, it's technically optimized, right? For years and years, we've been trying to optimize addressing plans, in particular with IPv4, to try to use the least possible space, right? Because every bit has an incredible value. Now you don't have that issue, that kind of issue with IPv6 when you get a /48 for any given campus, right, or any given site.
And it even seems like subnetting in IPv6, the idea is to go on the nibble boundary now.
Exactly.
You end up wasting tons of addresses in that scenario, and it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter at all, right? And so people need to get rid of that mentality that they need to save. No, you don't need to save. You need to be wasteful because there is value in being wasteful.
Yeah, now it's a management problem, and you can optimize for management and ease of use as opposed to address space. Yeah.
Exactly. And then you can build, you know, for example, think about your filtering, your ACL strategy, right? If you were able to filter on one particular bit to know if this is finance versus HR, that would be so much simpler than having to do some deep packet inspection sometime. I'm not saying that we shouldn't do DPI, but, you know, in certain cases, if you build the logic in your addressing plan, you know, you can start implementing business rules, you know, in a much more, you know, programmable and clean way. Mm. Yeah. And so very large corporations are realizing that there is value in that, right? And so if they need scale, right, if they have these kind of issues, they value V6 for that, you know, elbow room, right, that give them the simplicity and the programmability in a way.
I get it, yeah.
Right? So that's the second reason why people may want to deploy V6 internally. The other reason is related to specific industry drivers, right? If you're looking at electricity utilities, for example, the smart meters talk V6 only. They don't talk V4 at all, right? So if you are a PG&A or if you are an EDF in France or you know, an E.ON in Germany, you have to deploy V6 for your smart grid infrastructure. And your smart grid infrastructure will very, very quickly become a lot bigger than the rest of your IT systems.
Because you've got so many endpoints that are out there, you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. And so this one is going to be IPv6 only. You know, there will be... There is a need for deploying V6 in your normal IT infrastructure because there are people supporting this smart grid infrastructure and applications. And so naturally, you know, you see V6 for those categories of customers becoming, you know, center stage, becoming very, very important for the, you know, their strategic assets. So that's true for a public utility. It's true for automotive industry. It's true for airspace, you know, and, you know, those kind of industries. So you're going to see those kind of things in the future, and it's already happening in a number of places.
Now, you told me, just speaking of aerospace, you told me an interesting story before we started recording about Aerobus. Can you share that?
Yeah, sure. The story, actually, it's good lessons learned, right? One day, you know, we got a call from... an IT manager at Airbus, and they realized that a very large proportion of... Well, let me try to set the stage first. This is not about the public internet here. We're talking about an extranet that is used for, you know, providing information about planes, right, to their customers, and their customers are airlines and probably some military air force all over the world. Mm-hmm. And so they were, you know, they looked at their DNS statistics and realized quite a few years ago, actually, that's not a recent information, but quite a few years ago, they realized that a very significant proportion in the range of 20-30% of the DNS requests for their extranet websites were actually asking for a Quad A record, which basically means that something like 20-30% of their customers, their users, were already on IPv6. And they were not serving those Quad A records. They were turning them down and were serving them just an NA record, an IPv4 address. But that was a kind of a warning that they had to do something to serve those customers, right? Serve those end users that were already on IPv6. So it's something to maybe think about. Right.
That's an interesting metric right there, that high. I mean, it was an extranet, as you said, not public internet, but it might be interesting for anybody that's got public internet or potentially IPv6 facing services. How many inbound DNS queries are looking for a Quad A record?
Absolutely. So that's a very interesting place to monitor, right? If you want to understand how many of your customers out there are trying to reach you over V6, right? And if you serve them, fine, but if you don't, that's the total addressable market for you. And you can monitor over time and see the progression. Mm. Right? It should be, by the way, it should be very close to what, you know, places like the Internet Society is monitoring the IPv6 penetration in the largest ISPs all around the world. Google is actually monitoring that too. They do it on a country-per-country basis. Akamai is doing it too. All this data is being aggregated and reported by the Internet Society. And it gives you an indication of what is the percentage of end users penetration in a given geography or in a given ISP. So if you monitor your DNS, you should get similar data.
Let me ask you a vendor-oriented question. Now, you're with Cisco. Cisco's been a leader in IPv6 for a long time. I mean, I'm going back 10-ish years and had IPv6 in Cisco training that I was taking back in my CCNP and early CCIE days. So that's not new. It's been part of the curriculum. There's been a lot of education there. And it's certainly Cisco's been in different iOS releases for a very long time, adding and including IPv6 features. There's nothing new, mature offerings in that space. But again, because of my work on the podcast and talking to a lot of other companies that are in the space, mostly networking companies, a lot of them aren't caring about IPv6 particularly or baking IPv6 support into their products. Now, maybe that's because some of those products are kind of internal products as opposed to routers or switches that sit on the internet backbone, that sort of thing. But still, I would think IPv6 would be at this point, 2015, something that's just offered by default and it's baked in and you could kind of count on it being there, but that's not the case. Why do you suppose that is, and what's it going to take to change that?
You are absolutely right, actually. So one of the things, I can tell you what the position is at Cisco, and it will kind of infer the reasons why this is the case in other vendors maybe. One thing that we've been trying to do for quite a long time, not as long as you may think, actually. So it's not something that's starting at the very beginning of IPv6. But the last few years, we've tried to drive IPv6 as, it's not a business case question. It's something you have to do by default, right? You know, most of our products run over IP. And IP today is not a single version. There are two versions of it. The two versions need to be supported. So you need to have parity as much as possible.
But that's a mindset Cisco as an organization chose to make. There's no longer a use case distinction. Oh, if you need IPv6, we'll support it. You've just said IP runs over two different versions. We support both of those versions by default. That's how you approach things.
Yes. Now, there is a caveat to that, right? The caveat is new things that are being developed have to be developed on both protocols at the same time, because the cost of delivering any feature on V4 and V6 is minuscule as opposed to just do it on V4 only. What costs a lot is to reopen the hood, create a new project to add IPv6 to a product or a feature or a functionality that was V4 only and may not have been designed to support 128 bits addresses. Right?
Yes.
So try to converge on single APIs, single infrastructure, so that it's a non-issue. And the cost of that is, you know, no more than 10% maximum. If you do V4 and then hope that you're going to add V6 later on, the incremental cost is much, much more than that. Right? Mm. Now, the caveat is there is a lot of stuff that have been developed with V4 only in the past. How much of that you need to bring forward over to V6? Because for those, it's an incremental cost, right? For those, and we do have some products and features at Cisco that fall into this category of stuff that we've been doing over V4 forever. And then you start scratching your head and start thinking, wait, if I need to run my infrastructure on V6 only, and I don't have my V4 clunch anymore, is everything going to work? Am I going to be able to TFTP into my box? Am I going to be able to syslog out of my box? I'm going to do NetFlow out of my box. Can I do my radius over V6? So it's not so much about the data plane and the control plane, because this has been supported for quite a long time. It's everything else that is needed. And that requires a very specific attention and a lot of get well plans and a lot of, sweat and blood to actually do it, right? And so...
But certainly new products coming to market, there's really no reason it should be IPv4 only at all. We'll bolt on IPv6 later.
Exactly. And that's the policy that we've had at Cisco. And again, I'm not saying we're perfect. I'm sure you're gonna find a place where we haven't done that. Cisco is a big company, so I'm sure we've missed a few, and we'll continue to miss a few. But it's kind of a policy that we had, and we've had for quite some time, that you know new products should be supporting V6 the same way they support V4.
Mm. Now, another question that is worth chatting about here is education. Now, I know, I've already had a bunch of people ask me if I'm going to Cisco Live US this year, which I don't think I'm going to make the show this year. But you had pointed out to me that there's tons of education if you want to learn about IPv6, Cisco Live being one of those places.
So we've done two things actually at events like Cisco Live, both in the US or in Europe, or even in other regional versions of it. We have IPv6 specific sessions, so where you can go and learn about the latest and greatest about IPv6, you know. But we've also made sure that every session that talks about anything really, right, that has IPv4 in it, has IPv6 as well. So if you want to go into a routing session, or you know, you want to learn the details of advanced BGP, this session will cover both V4 and V6 equally. Right?
IPv6 is not treated as a separate track?
Both, actually. So we have V6 treated as a separated track only for the things that are specific to V6.
Okay.
So if you want to know about neighbor discovery, for example, this is going to be an IPv6 specific track. But if you want to know about ISIS, the ISIS session will cover both V4 and V6 equally.
Got it.
Right? And so we want to make that very clear. So there are tons of sessions. Some of them are V6 specific, and others are just, they treat V4 and V6 equally, right? And I think it's the best way to do it. You know, feature parity is not only a product issue. It's an education issue. It's a management issue. It's an application issue. We're trying to make V4 and V6, you know, kind of live at the same level here.
Mm. And I guess there's some panels you had mentioned here is one of talking to people who actually deployed it and their experiences.
Yes, we've been doing that for quite a few years, actually. I think in the US we had an interruption last year because we couldn't make it, but we've been trying to bring customers forward, right? And so in San Diego, you're going to have a bunch of customers, Comcast, Microsoft, Oracle, coming on stage and speaking about their own experience in deploying V6 and why they've done it, how they've done it, and the do's and don'ts, you know, kind of things. Because we want to make people feel, you know, good that, you know, other people have done it. They've done it successfully, right? This isn't an impossible task to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
And not an easy task necessarily, but not an impossible one to achieve. Something that is useful to do and strategic to do for the long run. And that, you know, learn on other people's experiences, basically. So that there is a panel dedicated to that, and we've been doing that for, you know, ongoing now. So, Ethan, before we, I don't know if you have more questions, but let me point you to two sites which I think are extremely important if you want to understand how and where IPv6 is being deployed and to what extent.
Yeah, go for it.
One is called worldipv6launch.org/measurements. Well, actually, you can go to the worldipv6launch.org. It's an Internet Society website that collects information about IPv6 deployments. And there is a particular page, /measurements, that give you indications about how many users are being deployed, what is the level of content available, the ISP and country by country. So that's a very useful site. There is a second one that is probably more at a glance, that provides, different kind of information, but also useful. It's one that I've created at Cisco. It's called sixlab.cisco.com. There is a mobile site and a regular browser site, and it gives you indication about the network deployment, the ISP networks, It gives you information about how much content is available on the internet. It gives you information about what is the percentage of users with IPv6 connectivity country by country. And the thing that is interesting with this site is that we've been collecting those stats since, in some cases, 2008. So we do have a lot of historical data and graphs. And so you can see the progression, the growth in each of these categories over time, by country, by region. We don't go, you know, more granular than country for obvious confidentiality reason. Mm-hmm. But it gives you a real good indication if you sit in Belgium or you sit in Germany or you sit in the U.S., how many people are IPv6 enabled out there? And what is the percentage of content that is available? You know, what does the internet look like in my country in terms of IPv6 enablement? All those are important questions to drive your business decisions on when you should be enabling IPv6 wherever you are.
And I will have the links to both of those sites in the show notes. So if you go up to packetpushers.net and look for this show in the Priority Queue channel, you will have those links right there for worldipv6launch.org/measurements and sixlab.cisco.com. And yeah, that's always good information. And I think if we could kind of summarize this conversation, it's IPv6 is actually growing rapidly. It's probably at the edge of your network now or will be very soon. And then now it becomes an issue of no matter what size company you are, serving up IPv6 to those consumers that are ready to take it. And then from there, making the transition to IPv6 yourself. And I guess Alain, one of the things that you had mentioned to me early on is there's no reason people can't do this. It's just time to get educated and move ahead if you've been holding off.
Yes, absolutely. Today, you know, if you have a product in your infrastructure that does not support it at all, it's probably time to look at it seriously and look at this vendor in the eye and ask the tough question.
Yeah.
Okay. It's probably the right time to do so.
Well, thanks very much for calling me out and for taking the time to come on and just record, because this is valuable information and sets perspective for people that are thinking about IPv6 or aren't interested in it or keep putting it off because it's not part of their world. It probably is part of the world. This is something Ed Horley has brought up in some of his presentations I've heard him make. Ed, who's written a book on IPv6 on Microsoft. And he'll bring out the point, you don't think you're running IPv6 maybe, but in fact you are. If you start looking at your network, it's there. It's already running.
Yes, absolutely. And that's one of the, you know, that's one of the big advantage and one of the worst disadvantage of IPv6 is that the deployment has been happening silently in the background, transparently for the end users. So they have it. They probably don't know it. And they don't realize the value that they can get from that protocol. And, you know, it was done by design, actually. The entire technical community wanted IPv6 to be deployed without the end users knowing, because nobody felt that it was important for the end users to know. Mm. But the flip side of that is because they don't know, they don't pay attention. Right?
Exactly. So
it makes the education challenge even tougher.
Well, Alain, is there anywhere that you tweet or blog that people could follow you?
I do, actually. I have two Twitter handles. One is called Cisco Six Lab, and that's basically one that is straight out of the website that I was mentioning. Right, so I'm tweeting about IPv6 adoption in the world. And the other one is a personal one, is Alain Fiocco on Twitter. And I usually that's where I send the information when I capture some interesting things to share with the community. And one thing that I would advise people to do is monitor the hashtag IPv6 on Twitter. There are a lot of really good information being shared by the community there.
Very good. And I'm Ethan Banks at EC Banks on Twitter. EthanCBanks.com is my blog. And this has been a Packet Pushers podcast. The Priority Queue is a channel where we put all kinds of interesting nuggets of information that maybe don't make it on the weekly show, but we definitely want to share with our audience still. You can email us about this or anything else on your mind, packetpushers@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter @packetpushers. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.